Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Often in Latin America, the great political and cultural thinkers aren't journalists, they're novelists. Carlos Fuentes, whose work is required reading in Mexico schools, is that kind of novelist. Last week, we discussed his most recent work, Destiny and Desire. Today, we focus on what drives culture in general, and in particular, where it's headed in Mexico, a country that finds itself in turbulent times. Now, Carlos, you have taken as your central place, Mexico City, much as Joyce took Dublin, much as Balzac took Paris. Take me to Mexico. What is the state of culture that you perceive?
Mexico, as well, and I would generalize as well as Latin America, has a thriving culture, a continuity of culture, in comparison with a dearth of politics and economics. The political life is way, way, way behind the cultural life of the country. Mexico has had an uninterrupted culture since the time of the Nahuatl or Aztec regime before the conquest. Then it became a Spanish colony, an independent country, and the culture has had no breaks. There have been a lot of political breaks in Mexico. There have been revolutions. There have been disasters. All kinds of things have interrupted the political and economic life, but nothing has been able to interrupt the cultural life. And I could say this of the rest of Latin America as well. So that is our greatest strength. And our greatest challenge is to bring the political life to the level of the cultural life. I know it's very difficult, but it's a challenge we have. Why do we have such a great culture and such mediocre politics?
Now, I'm curious. In Mexico, there are great traditions of the high arts, the bellas artes, as well as the folkloric arts. Where and how do they meet? Do they meet?
Yeah, they meet constantly because there is a continuum in which the so-called popular culture, be it the higher culture. We have a great bolero writer, Agustín Lara, who's very hummed all over the world and very famous. Even when people don't know their name, they're humming Agustín Lara tunes. And these tunes are set to a language that derives from the symbolist poets of the turn of the century. Poets nobody reads anymore, like Tomás Urbina, but he's at the back, Ramado Nervo. They're at the back of the bolero and the other musical forms that are so popular. So there is a communication between the cultures which give a lot from the so-called popular culture to the culture of the elites, but then it comes back also. What is written by the elites turns back to the culture of the masses that start saying things and repeating things that were really created at the elitist level of the culture. So this means that there is a livelihood to the culture, a continuity of the culture that would not be there if you didn't have the two factors intermingling.
Yes, I notice that in the Mandarin and remarkable works of Borges, he's also gifted about telling us about the tango and about the gangster traditions of Buenos Aires, that in South America and Latin America, hand in hand, the high and the low need to consider one another. And it seems to me that García Márquez is one of the great instances of the joining of the local folklore with the highest mechanics, architecture, of which the novel is capable.
I think that's right, and I think you could say of almost any great writer. I think we've been mentioning Balzac, we've been mentioning Faulkner. Faulkner, the whole culture of the South is there. The idiom of the South, the rhythms of the South are there, with Alan Tate called Dixie Gongorism, a very high sense of literature that comes from Gongora. Who reads Gongora in this world except a few crazy Latin Americans and Spaniards? So to have a Dixie Gongoras was at the same time deeply rooted in the plantations, the slave culture, the black culture, the property culture, the culture of power and dominion in the southern United States gives you novels like Absalom, Absalom, or The Sound and the Fury.
Well, I've been talking to Spanish novelists, Spanish-speaking novelists born in Mexico, living in Texas, who tell me that now we will have the novel of the drug culture and the music of the drug culture as well, but there will still be a culture that we endlessly generate one another, the high and the low.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true there. We're constantly affecting each other from the low to the middle to the high and back. It's a round trip. That is where culture is vital, because it does not exclude, it includes. Even the worst features of a society are presented in the culture. I don't think the culture shies away from any manifestation, any aspect of itself, finally, because it is itself.
Carlos, do you expect a return of the high at any time, of the high culture?
I think it's there. I think it's there. I think that when I was a young man in your country, opera was a thing of fun. The Marx Brothers did, Marx Brothers at the opera. People make fun of the opera. Today I go to the Met in New York, and it's revered. It's an experience shared by millions of people, now also in television. We get the productions of the Met in high-definition screens in Mexico, and thousands of people go to the National Auditorium, which holds more than 12,000 people who hear the representations of the Met. This means that high culture and low culture is a difficult distinction, because when opera, which used to be the very definition of high opera, becomes a part of the popular culture of a great mass of people, then how do you find it as high culture only? Mozart and Verdi only for a few? Of course not. More and more people enter the realm of the opera, as more and more people enter the realm of the arts, of literature as well, even if literature is more difficult because it is written and you need a book. You're not passive. In literature, you must be very active. But as you see, the film, theater, music, and the arts are gaining public, not losing it.
I'm talking to Carlos Fuentes about culture and the arts. He's the author, most recently, of Destiny and Desire. Do you think that there will be a point at which education returns the standards of literacy so that the novel has a rebirth?
Yes, I think so. I think that education is the basis of everything. We are leaving many people outside the realm of education and therefore out of the realm of the arts, out of the realm of reading and seeing and hearing and arts in general. Let us look at the state of education in order to understand the state of culture and the state of a society.
Now, give me a picture. A young person in Mexico, let's say Mexico City, when does he enter school and what is the state of public education?
Today we're 110 million. And to bring education to all of these, it does reach a certain level. But listen, I go to Veracruz, which is my home state, and I see that kids have to go to school mounted on a donkey for a two-hour ride to school and a two-hour ride back to their homes. Or you have buses that teach people. They go from town to town, but only children and women attend. Men do not. And their basic teachings. This is the great challenge of our societies, because if we don't have education, we'll have nothing else.
When I was in Paris, I discovered, to my surprise and delight, that young people were not particularly interested in Rambo. They said, oh, we learned him by heart in school. We're sick of Rambo. Who are the writers and poets in Mexico who a school child would know?
Very few of the ones are there in the curriculum. I have the fortune of being in the curriculum, so is Octavio Paz, Juan Rulfo, and a few older poets, writers, novelists, but not very many. If you're in the curriculum, you keep up your readership. It's now, a blessing.
Which book of yours is most commonly read?
I think Aura would be, because Aura, which is a ghost story,
yes,
was banned by the Minister of Labor in the preceding government of Fox. He said that children, young people, should not read Aura. It was an immoral book, and the young woman who taught it was thrown out of her school, and my sales skyrocketed to 20,000 copies a week. So I said, should I give thanks to the minister? But the question is, I asked, why is the book being censored by the Catholics? He said, because the couple makes love under a crucifix. He said, but all Mexicans make love under a crucifix. What's the novelty of this?
Now tell me, the Calderon government, mm-hmm. where do they stand on literature and the arts?
I think they're sympathetic to it. It's a center-right government. They wouldn't dare be against literature. They had a very meager celebration of the bicentennial of Mexican independence last September. The dictator Porfirio Diaz inaugurated monuments, books, anything. He did a grand celebration. The Calderon government made a very meager celebration, very small celebration of the bicentennial, which will now be a tricentennial 100 years from now. But in the meantime, it showed up that Mexico is a country with so many problems, and the solutions that would be good in Switzerland, mind you. In a country of that kind, well, okay, yeah. But in a country like Mexico, you have to renew the policies in order to bring more and more people into education, into work, into health. You have to do a great job of this, really a crusade. And there are Mexicans aged 30 or less than 30 who are going to expect this opportunity, who might go to crime. They are the ninis.
What are ninis?
They're neither, how do you say it in English? Ni trabajo, ni educación.
Neither educated nor having jobs.
They lack both. And what happens to them is what happens to the country. If they go on being ninis, or if they go to the drug bans, it's one thing. If we offer them a Mexican New Deal to modernize the country, to build all that has not been built in the last 30 or 40 years, ports, highways, health, education, et cetera, et cetera. The whole thing the New Deal did in this country, which is a revolution without blood being spilt, which is what I would like for my country, that the ninis become a force for change in Mexico, a change that is long overdue.
I'm talking with Carlos Fuentes, author most recently of Destiny and Desire. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We've been talking about culture and the arts and the possibility of bringing culture to a wider audience through the possibilities of education in a country like Mexico, where the enormity, the size of the country and the population make it a crusade rather than a natural progression. We have an opportunity for you who are listening to Carlos Fuentes as a lover and as a fan, because we have signed copies of his most recent novel, Destiny and Desire, published by Random House. Quantities are limited, so go to kcrw.com/store and buy a copy of Destiny and Desire and see how you can spread the gospel of Carlos Fuentes. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Carlos Fuentes, the great and greatest living Mexican writer. Carlos, please tell me, what are we going to do? What is it possible to do for the ninis? The ninis are, in a certain sense, an abbreviation, ni educación, ni trabajo, neither study nor jobs. Okay, you have, people estimate, between 7 and 8 million ninis.
In 2 years, we have a renewal of powers, executive and legislative, and I think that we're going to have surprises. Right now, the three major parties, left, center, and right, are fractured. They do not have majorities. But I think that eventually, if we're going to solve these problems, we're going to have to face a national movement for the solution of these problems. It might happen, might occur because of the elections in 2 years' time. It will start perhaps breeding right now. What shape it will take, how many people it will concern is a mystery, of course. I'm not a reader of the future, but I think that it is in the cards in the country, as it was in 1910. Violently in 1910. I think in 2011, 2012, it should be peaceful, which is to have people say, hey, you're not doing enough for education. You're not doing enough for health. You're not doing enough for all the bad things that matter in our lives. But you think you're doing okay. You're doing okay if this were Switzerland, but it's Mexico, and it's Colombia, and it's Peru, and it's Bolivia, and it's Chile, and we have to do something more. And that is going to be a great jump. I hope it takes place peacefully, but there's going to be a surge of the younger people of Mexico to say, hey, we have this catalog of problems. Let us hurry up and solve them. If not, we're going to go down. It's going to be dreadful. And I think the government is not quite aware of this. I think the business class is not quite aware. I'm sure that the corporative system, the unions in Mexico, are not aware. They all have a kind of mindset that comes from 50 years of so-called institutionalized revolution, which is very hard to change. But it must change if it's going to accept the new realities of the growing population of Mexico.
How do you think the presence of narco-violence will affect efforts like a New Deal or a new political amalgamation?
You know, the narco system in Mexico is really strange because it's not evident. We know it's there. We know the damage it causes. It is not the totality of the country, of its economy, of its society. No way. It is part of it. And it's not visible. I have a couple of friends, intellectuals, Hector Aguilar Camín and Jorge Castañeda, who do trips through all the states of Mexico. They give lectures everywhere. They're not bothered by any narco drug dealers or anybody. And they don't even see them. Because the magic of the drug dealer, if they call it that way, is that they're no different from you and me. They don't wear uniforms. They don't have badges. They look like civilians. So they hide in the society very, very well. They fight amongst themselves, and sometimes they fight the government. They fight the army. There are lots of dead people. But it's a very curious phenomenon whose actual physiognomy we do not know yet. What it might come to, we don't know. Whether for good or evil, we don't know what the future of this system will be. Because, Michael, because this is a problem we share with the United States of America. And as long as there is no understanding that the problem will not be solved unless the United States accepts its responsibility in being the country of the demand of drugs. Drugs are produced and exported because American consumers want them. Who are these consumers? How do the drugs get to them? And besides, where do we get the arms? The drug dealers, where do they get the arms? They buy them from the United States. So there is a complicity here, and there is a common responsibility for both governments to attack this problem, which is not only a problem, a bilateral problem of Mexico and the United States. It's a worldwide problem. I have joined a group which is headed by former Presidents Cardoso of Brazil, Gaviria of Colombia, and Zedillo of Mexico, in which we're saying, hey, the present policy has failed. Let us think for other avenues to deal with this problem. Let us separate drug users who are criminals from those who are not. Don't send drug users who are not criminals to jail. Send them to a hospital. Start thinking of legalizing drugs, of legitimizing the use of certain drugs. Let's have a whole new developing policy. This is what the most we can do at this moment. I think it's a good thing.
Now, that's the most we can do as humans. As a visionary novelist, would you tell me something of a story that will help me think about the border between Mexico and the United States? Not as a citizen, not as a former dignitary, as a visionary novelist.
there is a new culture being born in the border between the United States and Mexico. I would call it Mex-America. It partakes of both cultures, of both countries. And there is a great influence of the United States in Mexico. It suffices to walk down any avenue and see the ads, American products. Very few Mexicans speak English, very few. And we keep our traditions are very much alive in culinary, love, ways of thinking, acting, speaking. We're very much in our mestizo tradition, Spanish and Indian, not that affected by American culture. Whereas I think the Mexican presence in this country is very prominent and very much into itself. There's this secret consciousness in many of my compatriots in the United States that they're in California, they're in Arizona, they're in New Mexico, they're in Texas, and that this used to be our land, and it is no longer. Nobody says it out loud. It's a fact, but it's secondary. The fact is that all these people that are coming from Spanish-speaking America to the United States have to integrate into the United States. There has to be a policy in this country of yours that admits the diversity of these people. And the fact, the very interesting fact, they're not coming across the ocean like former immigrants used to. They're coming across a land border. That makes all the difference. But how you integrate them into your culture is very important. Many have integrated. I know so many people of Mexican descent in all the border states who are Americans, 100% Americans, even in the worst sense of the word. But there should be a policy of integration with a humanitarian sense, with a humane sense that they're not a strange species and that they do have very, very important relationships with the home country. But I think the Poles and the Italians and the Germans did also in the past. Yet they finally integrated into the great American society.
Now, I want to ask a final question, and it does join geopolitics with literature. France, so dominant in the culture of the novel for so long, is now barely spoken of. They don't have a vital community of novelists who are doing accessible work. There is the art novel, and then there's the popular novel, Never the Twain Shall Meet, and it's over, in a sense. Now, in Mexico, I keep being exposed to a very vital young writing community, both in the novel and culture. And certainly, Spanish became a dominant language in culture because of Neruda before Lorca, later García Márquez, Carlos Fuentes, Jorge Luis Borges, Vargas Llosa won the Pulitzer Prize. And it seems to me that Spanish is part of living world culture. It's not like when I first went to college speaking Spanish and was told by the people that, no, Spanish was a language. If you were going into business, if you were going into the fashion dress business in New York, it would be helpful to speak Spanish. But now, Spanish is the culture, and Don Quixote is the fount of the novel. Where does the future of the Mexican novel take us? What do you predict?
Well, the Mexican novel, let me say first of all, is part of the novel of the Spanish language. It is a novel that goes along with what is written in Chile and Colombia and Argentina and Spain. So we have a community of Spanish language writers. We have a community of Spanish-speaking peoples. We do not have an economic community, a political community, but at least you know when our heads of state meet, there are 20 heads of state who can understand each other in the same language. And when I meet a writer from Paraguay or Uruguay, I can understand him or her very well, and he or she me. We have a community of language which is even more pronounced than in the Anglo-speaking world, where there are so many differences between what is spoken in a black African country or a country in the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, or England and the United States. As Bernard Shaw once says, the United States and England are separated by the Atlantic Ocean. It's a huge difference between the two cultures. We don't have that. We are very united in the sense of the language and the cultures. Then come the politics and the economics, and we are diverse. But at least we have that strength of identity given to us by the Spanish language, which was refused as a language of communication when I was a young man in your country, and I asked people to speak in Spanish, they would refuse to. It would brand them as aliens, people who are not integrated into the United States. Now a candidate for the presidency has to speak Spanish to get votes. It's a totally different picture from what happened 20 or 30 years ago. And it's all to the good because finally we are going towards a world community. I think President Obama is being very good in speaking for the first time of the globalization of work, which is a thing that affects us very much. Because you have a globalization of finance, money travels easily, trade travels easily, but work does not. Work is impeded. Work is subject to humiliations, to borders. And Obama, when he speaks of the globalization of work, he is telling us that we like to hear in Mexico. So we're heading towards that, a full globalization in which everybody will contribute his or her culture, but no culture will be predominant, though the English language is very predominant as ways of communication, though the Spanish culture is very predominant as a way of feeling and expression. This won't matter because, after all, we will live together or we won't live at all. That is the question today. How can we live together? And what is the option? It is not living differently. It is not living, period.
And the novel.
The novel is going to express what cannot be said in any other way.
Continue to express what cannot
yes,
be said.
Yes, what you can say in journalism, what you can say in movies or even in theater, philosophy, essays, is wonderful, but then it is what the novel can say, which is the contradiction of languages, the coexistence of diverse languages in one work, the possibility of having fiction, characters, plot, journalism, economy, philosophy, everything comes together in a great novel, as Ulysses proves. And so if we do away with that, we'll be mutilating ourselves. We will have one less arm and maybe we'll lose both.
I've been speaking with Carlos Fuentes, author most recently of Destiny and Desire, published by Random House. Thank you, Carlos, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. Great pleasure always.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this, I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.